Chapter 2. Truth Hurts. Wilmoth Irving was a new beginning. Up until he met my mother and asked for her phone number, all I'd known was misery and struggle. When the money was good, our lives were defined by trauma. Once we were free of my father, we were swept under by our own PTSD-level dysfunction and poverty. Then, when I was in fourth grade, she met Wilmoth, a successful carpenter and general contractor from Indianapolis. She was attracted to his easy smile and laid-back style. There was no violence in him. He gave us permission to exhale. With him around, it felt like we had some support, like something good was finally happening to us. She laughed when they were together. Her smile was bright and real. She stood up a little straighter. He gave her pride and made her feel beautiful again. As for me, Wilmoth became as close to a healthy father figure as I've ever had. He didn't coddle me. He didn't tell me he loved me or any of that fake-ass sappy shit, but he was there. Basketball had been an obsession of mine since grade school. It was the core of my relationship with my best friend, Johnny Nichols, and Wilmoth had game. He and I hit the courts together all the time. He showed me moves, tuned up my defensive discipline, and helped me develop a jump shot. The three of us celebrated birthdays and holidays together, and the summer before eighth grade, he got down on one knee and asked my mother to make it official. Wilmoth lived in Indianapolis, and our plan was to move in with him the following summer. Though he wasn't nearly as rich as Trunis, he made a nice living, and we looked forward to city life again. Then, in 1989, the day after Christmas, everything stopped. We hadn't made the full-time move to Indy yet, and he'd spent Christmas Day with us at my grandparents' place in Brazil. The next day, he had a basketball game in his men's league, and he'd invited me to sub for one of his teammates. I was so excited I'd packed my bags 2 days early. But that morning he told me I couldn't come after all. "I'm going to keep you back here this time, little David," he said. I dropped my head and sighed. He could tell I was upset and tried to reassure me. "Your mom is going to drive up in a few days and we can play ball then." I nodded reluctantly, but I wasn't raised to pry into the affairs of adults and knew I wasn't owed an explanation or makeup game. My mother and I watched from the front porch as he backed out of the carport, smiled, and gave us that crisp single wave of his. Then he drove off. It was the last time we'd ever see him alive. He played in his men's league game that night as planned, and drove home alone to the house with the White Lions. Whenever he gave directions to friends, family, or delivery guys, that's how he always described his ranch-style house, its driveway framed by two White Lion sculptures elevated on pillars. He pulled between them and into the garage, where he could enter the house directly, oblivious to the danger moving in from behind. He never did close that garage door. They'd been staking him out for hours, waiting for a window, and as he climbed out from the driver's side door, they stepped from the shadows and fired from close range. He was shot 5 times in the chest. When he dropped to the floor of his garage, the gunman stepped over him and delivered a kill shot right between his eyes. Wilmoth's father lived a few blocks away, and when he drove by the White Lions the next morning, he noticed his son's garage door open and knew something was wrong. He walked up the driveway and into the garage, where he sobbed over his dead son. Wilmoth was just 43 years old. I was still at my grandmother's house when Wilmoth's mother called moments later. She hung up and motioned me to her side to break the news. I thought about my mom. Wilmoth had been her savior. She'd been coming out of her shell, opening up, ready to believe in good things. What would this do to her? Would God ever give her a damn break? It started as a simmer, but within seconds my rage overwhelmed me. I broke free of my grandmother, punched the refrigerator, and left a dent. We drove to our place to find my mother, who was already frantic because she hadn't heard from Wilmoth. She called his house just before we arrived, and when a detective picked up the phone, it puzzled her. But she didn't expect this. How could she? We saw her confusion as my grandmother walked over, peeled the phone from her fingers, and sat her down. She didn't believe us at first. Wilmoth was a prankster, and this was just the kind of fucked-up stunt he might try to pull off. Then she remembered he'd been shot 2 months before. He told her that the guys who'd done it weren't after him, that those bullets were meant for someone else, and because they merely grazed him, she decided to forget about the whole thing. Until that moment, she never suspected that Wilmoth had some secret street life she knew nothing about, and the police never did find out exactly why he was shot and killed. The speculation was that he was involved in a shady business deal or a drug deal gone bad. My mother was still in denial when she packed a bag, but she included a dress for his funeral. When we arrived, his house was wrapped in a ribbon of yellow police tape, like a fucked-up Christmas gift. This was no prank. My mom parked, ducked under the tape, and I followed right behind her to the front door. On the way, I remember glancing to my left, trying to get a glimpse of the scene where Wilmoth had been killed. His cold blood was still pooled on the garage floor. I was a 14-year-old wandering through an active crime scene, but nobody, not my mother, not Wilmoth's family, and not even the police seemed disturbed by me being there, absorbing the heavy vibe of my would-be stepfather's murder. As fucked up as it sounds, the police allowed my mom to stay in Wilmoth's house that night. Rather than stay alone, she had her brother-in-law there, armed with his two guns in case the killers came back. I wound up in a back bedroom at Wilmoth's sister's place, a dark and spooky house a few miles away, and left alone all night. The house was furnished with one of those analog cabinet television sets with 13 channels on a dial. Only 3 channels came in static-free, and I kept it on the local news. They ran the same tape on a loop every 30 minutes. Footage of my mom and me ducking under police tape, then watching Wilmoth get wheeled on a gurney toward a waiting ambulance, a sheet over his body. It was like a horror scene. I sat there all alone, watching the same footage over and over. My mind was a broken record that kept skipping into darkness. The past had been bleak, and now our sky-blue future had been blown the fuck up too. There would be no reprieve, only my familiar fucked-up reality choking out all light. Each time I watched, my fear grew until it filled the room, and still, I could not stop. A few days after we buried Wilmoth, and just after the new year, I boarded a school bus in Brazil, Indiana. I was still grieving, and my head was spinning because my mother and I hadn't decided whether or not we were staying in Brazil or moving to Indianapolis as planned. We were in limbo, and she remained in a state of shock. She still hadn't cried over Wilmoth's death. Instead, she became emotionally vacant again. It was as if all the pain she'd experienced in her life resurfaced as one gaping wound she disappeared into, and there was no reaching her in that void. In the meantime, school was starting up, so I played along, looking for any shred of normal I could hang on to. But it was hard. I rode a bus to school most days, and my first day back I couldn't shake a memory I buried from the year before. That morning I slid into a seat above the back left tire overlooking the street as usual. When we arrived at school, the bus pulled up to the curb. We needed to wait for the ones ahead of us to move before we could get off. In the meantime, a car pulled alongside us, and a cute, overeager little boy ran toward our bus carrying a platter of cookies. The driver didn't see him. The bus jerked forward. I noticed the alarmed look on his mother's face before the sudden crush of blood splattered my window. His mother howled in horror. She wasn't among us anymore. She looked and sounded like a fierce, wounded animal as she literally pulled the hair from her head by the roots. Soon, sirens wailed in the distance and screamed closer by the second. The little boy was about 6 years old. The cookies were a present for the driver. We were all ordered off the bus, and as I walked by the tragedy, for some reason, call it human curiosity, call it the magnetic pull of dark to dark, I peeked under the bus and saw him. His head was nearly as flat as paper. His brains and blood mingled under the carriage like spent oil. For a full year, I hadn't thought of that image even once, but Wilmoth's death reawakened it, and now it was all I could think about. I was beyond the pale. Nothing mattered to me. I'd seen enough to know that the world was filled with human tragedy, and that it would just keep piling up in drifts until it swallowed me. Man, I remember when you first told me that story, and we were first starting to work together, and I'm like skeptical journalist guy, and even though I listened to your podcast and was a fan even before we'd ever hooked up,
right?
I was like, when you told me this story, I thought to myself, man, can that be true?
Right.
And it is, it is true. There's newspaper reports over it, and everything that you say in this book, we've checked out 100 different ways. And I mean, it is almost impossible to believe that so much you could have seen and witnessed so much, but it's 100% true. And I can't even imagine that scene. And the funny thing is, not funny, but like the odd thing is you actually suppressed this memory. You lived it, you felt it, but you didn't even talk about it. You didn't brought it up to your mother. Nothing ever happened. And then after Wilma's death, a full year later, that's when it came out.
Right. So what I was really good at growing up was I realized my mom was severely damaged and I became the man of the house. And my whole job was to show no weakness. You know, she had enough to worry about and I didn't want her ever worrying about me. So when that little boy, it was horrible. It was just horrible to see that. And I was in seventh grade and my little brain was just, you know, I couldn't even comprehend what I just saw. And to see a mom to that scene, to see a woman yanking her hair out of her head and just going all at it. And then I didn't know what that blood was. Hmm. I didn't even know that it was blood. I didn't know what had even happened. Cause I looked forward, and when I looked forward, all I heard was screaming. And when I looked over at the screaming, the lady was literally right across from me, and I saw little specks of, like, I didn't know it was blood then, but I saw little specks of, it looked like brown stuff on my window. And I just saw the woman looking down. So I got my window, and it was, you know, it was in the dead of winter, so that's the thing about it. It was literally December around the 22nd, 23rd, 24th. A year before Wilmoth died, he got murdered the day after Christmas. So it was almost a year to the day when this happened. So I got the window and I pulled it down and I looked down and what I saw was this, it looked like just a flat as a pancake. It was just flat as a pancake, man. It's even hard to talk about now. And, that stuck with me forever. But the thing about it is I always would get things, put them back in my head and move on. Just, you know, get hard. And what did it for me was I came home after seeing this little boy get run over by a bus. And once again, it was that gurney. It was on TV and I saw that gurney. And I think watching that gurney with that little boy and then seeing Wilmoth repeatedly in the gurney, those two gurneys, you know, just seeing that on TV, it just sparked up this stuff. And I'll never forget it, man.
And then getting back on the bus. So it was almost like you're going into this deja vu you couldn't get out of.
Right. And it was horrible. And I literally couldn't sleep in my bed. I'll never forget, you know, after Wilmoth got murdered and all this stuff kind of, all these horrible demons came to roost in my head. I just couldn't sleep in the bed. And I remember sleeping on the floor in the fetal position for months. And there was one night, you know, I thought I was very like what's wrong with me? So I actually went my mom's room one night to just, you know, talk to her. And I walked in her room. I'll never forget finding her in her chair in the fetal position. And then years later, she would tell me that, you know, she couldn't sleep in her bed. Years later, so she slept in the chair and I slept in the floor, you know, both of us in the fetal position.
I couldn't sleep in bed anymore. Neither could my mother. She slept in her armchair with the television on blast or with a book in her hands. For a little while, I tried to curl up in bed at night, but would always wake in the fetal position on the floor. Eventually, I gave in and bedded down low to the ground, maybe because I knew if I could find comfort at the bottom place, there would be no more falling. We were two people in dire need of the fresh start we thought we had coming, so even without Wilmoth, we made the move to Indianapolis. My mother set me up for entry exams at Cathedral High School, a private college preparatory academy in the heart of the city. As usual, I cheated, and off a smart motherfucker, too. When my acceptance letter and class schedule came in the mail the summer before freshman year, I was looking at a full slate of AP classes. I hacked my way through, cheating and copying, and managed to make the freshman basketball team, which was one of the best freshman teams in the entire state. We had several future college players, and I started at point guard. That was a confidence boost, but not the kind I could build on because I knew I was an academic fraud. Plus, the school cost my mom way too much money. So after only 1 year at Cathedral, she pulled the plug. I started my sophomore year at North Central High School, a public school with 4,000 kids in a majority black neighborhood, and on my first day, I turned up like some preppy-ass white boy. My jeans were definitely too tight, and my collared shirt was tucked into a waistline cinched with a braided belt. The only reason I didn't get completely laughed out of the building was because I could ball. My sophomore year was all about being cool. I switched up my wardrobe, which was increasingly influenced by hip-hop culture, and hung out with gangbangers and other borderline delinquents, which meant I didn't always go to school. One day my mom came home in the middle of the day and found me sitting around our dining room table with what she described as 10 thugs. She wasn't wrong. Within a few weeks, she packed us up and moved us back to Brazil, Indiana. I enrolled at Northview High School the week of basketball tryouts, and I remember showing up at lunchtime when the cafeteria was full. There were 1,200 kids enrolled at Northview, only 5 of which were black, and the last time any of them had seen me, I looked a lot like them. Not anymore. I strolled into school that day wearing pants 5 sizes too big and sagged way down low. I also wore an oversized Chicago Bulls jacket with a backward hat, cocked to the side. Within seconds, all eyes were upon me. Teachers, students, and administrative staff stared at me like I was some exotic species. I was the first thuggish black kid many of them had seen in real life. My mere presence had stopped the music. I was the needle being dragged across vinyl, scratching a whole new rhythm. And like hip-hop itself, everybody noticed, but not everyone liked what they heard. I strutted through the scene like I gave no fucks. But that was a lie. I acted all kinds of cocky, and my entrance was brash as hell, but I felt very insecure going back there. Buffalo had been like living in a blazing inferno. My early years in Brazil were a perfect incubator for post-traumatic stress, and before I left, I was delivered a double dose of death trauma. Moving to Indianapolis had been an opportunity to escape pity and leave all that behind. Class wasn't easy for me, but I'd made friends and developed a new style. Now, coming back, I looked different enough on the outside to perpetuate an illusion that I'd changed. But in order to change, you have to work through shit, confront it, and get real. I hadn't done a shred of that hard work. I was still a dumb kid with nothing solid to lean on, and basketball tryouts ripped away any confidence I had left. When I got to the gym, they made me suit up in uniform rather than wear my more generic gym clothes. Back then, the style was getting baggy and oversized, which Chris Webber and Jalen Rose of the Fab Five would make famous at the University of Michigan. The coaches in Brazil didn't have their fingers on that pulse. They put me in the tidy-whitey version of basketball shorts, which strangled my balls, hugged my thighs super tight, and felt all kinds of wrong. I was trapped in the coach's preferred dream state, a Larry Bird time warp, which made sense because Larry Legend was basically a patron saint in Brazil and all of Indiana. In fact, his daughter went to our school. We were friends, but that didn't mean I wanted to dress like him. Then there was my etiquette. In Indianapolis, the coaches let us talk shit on the court. If I made a good move or hit a shot in your face, I talked about your mama or your girlfriend. In Indy, I'd done research on my shit-talking. I got good at it. I was the Draymond Green of my school, and it was all part of basketball culture in the city. Back in farm country, that cost me. When tryouts started, I handled the rock a bunch, and when I crossed some of the kids over and made them look bad, I let them and the coaches know. My attitude embarrassed the coaches, who were apparently ignorant that their hero, Larry Legend, was an all-time great trash talker. And it wasn't long before they took the ball out of my hands and put me in the front court, a position I'd never played before. I was uncomfortable down low and played like it. That shut me up good. Meanwhile, Johnny was dominating. My only saving grace that week was getting back with Johnny Nichols. We'd stayed close while I was away, and our marathon one-on-one battles were back on full swing. Though he was undersized, he was always a nice player, and he was one of the best on the floor during tryouts. He was draining shots, seeing the open man, and running the court. It was no surprise when he made the varsity squad, but we were both shocked that I barely made JV. I was crushed, and not because of basketball tryouts. To me, that outcome was another symptom of something else I'd been feeling. Brazil looked the same, but shit felt different this time around. Grade school had been hard academically, but even though we were one of only a few black families in town, I didn't notice or feel any palpable racism. As a teenager, I experienced it everywhere, and it wasn't because I'd become ultra-sensitive. Outright racism had always been there. Not long after moving back to Brazil, my cousin Damien and I went to a party way out in the country. We stayed out well past curfew. In fact, we were up all night long, and after daybreak, we called our grandmother for a ride home. "Excuse me?" she asked. "You disobeyed me, so you may as well start walking." "Roger that." She lived 10 miles away, down a long country road, but we joked around and enjoyed ourselves as we started to stroll. Damien lived in Indianapolis, and we were both sagging our baggy jeans and dressed in oversized starter jackets. Not exactly typical gear on Brazil's country roads. We'd walked 7 miles in a few hours when a pickup truck came bouncing down the tarmac in our direction. We edged to the side of the road to let it pass, but it slowed down. And as it crept past us, we could see two teenagers in the cab and a third standing in the bed of the truck. The passenger pointed and yelled through his open window, "Niggers!" We didn't overreact. We put our heads down and kept walking at the same pace until we heard that beat-to-shit truck squeal to a stop on a patch of gravel and kick up a dust storm. That's when I turned and saw the passenger, a scruffy-looking redneck, exit the cab of the truck with a pistol in his hand. He aimed it at my head as he stalked toward me. "Where the fuck you from, and why the fuck you here in this fucking town?" Damien eased down the road while I locked eyes with the gunman and said nothing. He stepped within 2 feet of me. The threat of violence doesn't get much more real than that. Chills rippled my skin, but I refused to run or cower. After a few seconds, he got back in the truck and they sped off. It wasn't the first time I'd heard the word. Not long before that, I was hanging out in Pizza Hut with Johnny and a couple of girls, including a brunette I liked named Pam. She liked me too, but we'd never acted on it. We were two innocents enjoying one another's company, but when her father arrived to take her home, he caught sight of us, and when Pam saw him, her face went ghost white. He burst into the packed restaurant and stalked towards us with all eyes on him. He never addressed me. He just locked eyes with her and said, "I don't want to ever see you sitting with this nigger again." She hustled out the door after him, her face red with shame as I sat paralyzed, staring at the floor. It was the most humiliating moment of my life, and it hurt much more than the gun incident because it happened in public and the word had been spewed by a grown-ass man. I couldn't understand how or why he was filled with so much hate, and if he felt that way, how many other people in Brazil shared his point of view when they saw me walking down the street? It was the sort of riddle you didn't want to solve. They won't call on me if they can't see me. That was how I operated during my sophomore year in high school in Brazil, Indiana. I would hide out in the back rows, slump low in my chair, and sidestep my way through each and every class. Our high school made us take a foreign language that year, which was funny to me. Not because I couldn't see the value, but because I could barely read English, let alone understand Spanish. By then, after a good 8 years of cheating, my ignorance had crystallized. I kept leveling up in school, on track, but hadn't learned a damn thing. I was one of those kids who thought he was gaming the system when, the whole time, I'd been gaming myself. One morning, about halfway through the school year, I milled into Spanish class and grabbed my workbook from a back cupboard. There was technique involved in skating by. You didn't have to pay attention, but you did have to make it seem like you were. So I slumped into my seat, opened up my workbook, and fixed my gaze on the teacher who lectured from the front of the room. When I looked down at the page, the whole room went silent, at least to me. Her lips were still moving, but I couldn't hear, because my attention had narrowed on the message left for me, and me alone. We each had our own assigned workbook in that class, and my name was written in pencil at the top right corner of the title page. That's how they knew it was mine. Below that, someone had drawn an image of me in a noose. It looked rudimentary, like something out of the hangman game we used to play as kids. Below that were the words, "Nigger, we're gonna kill you." They'd misspelled it, but I had no clue. I could barely spell myself, and they'd made their fucking point. I looked around the room as my rage gathered like a typhoon until it was literally buzzing in my ears. "I'm not supposed to be here," I thought to myself. "I'm not supposed to be back in Brazil." I took inventory of all the incidents I'd already experienced and decided I couldn't take much more. The teacher was still talking when I rose up without warning. She called my name, but I wasn't trying to hear. I left the classroom, notebook in hand, and bolted to the principal's office. I was so enraged, I didn't even stop at the front desk. I walked right into his office and dropped the evidence on his desk. "I'm tired of this shit," I said. Kirk Freeman was the principal at that time, and to this day he still remembers looking up from his desk and seeing tears in my eyes. It wasn't some mystery why all this shit was happening in Brazil. Southern Indiana had always been a hotbed of racists, and he knew it. 4 years later, in 1995, the Ku Klux Klan would march down Brazil's main drag on Independence Day, in full hooded regalia. the KKK was active in Centerpoint, a town located not 15 minutes away, and kids from there went to our school. Some of them sat behind me in history class and told racist jokes for my benefit nearly every damn day. I wasn't expecting some investigation into who did it. More than anything, in that moment, I was looking for some compassion. And I could tell from the look in the Principal Freeman's eyes, he felt bad about what I was going through, but he was at a loss. He didn't know how to help me. Instead, he examined the drawing and the message for a long beat, then raised his eyes to mine, ready to console me with his words of wisdom. "David, this is sheer ignorance," he said. "They don't even know how to spell nigger." My life had been threatened, and that was the best he could do. The loneliness I felt leaving his office is something I'll never forget. It was scary to think that there was so much hate flowing through the halls and that someone I didn't even know wanted me dead because of the color of my skin. The same question kept looping through my mind. Who the fuck is out here who hates me like this? I had no idea who my enemy was. Was it one of the rednecks from history class? Or was it somebody I thought I was cool with but who really didn't like me at all? It was one thing staring down the barrel of a gun on the street or dealing with some racist parent. At least that shit was honest. Wondering who else felt that way in my school was a different kind of unnerving, and I couldn't shake it off. Even though I had plenty of friends, all of them white, I couldn't stop seeing the hidden racism scrawled all over the walls in invisible ink, which made it extremely hard to carry the weight of being the only. It's tough, you know, for me to read this. It's almost, you know, it's almost me saying the word doesn't even feel right because right. You know, because it's not for me to say.
Right.
And to feel it, you know, it's difficult even for me to read it. I can't even imagine you having to go through it.
Well, the thing about it is there was two different people when I was going through high school, especially in high school. No one knew about any of this stuff. It wasn't like I walked around and said, you know, woe is me, feel sorry for me. You know, I didn't tell anybody anything. I told Kurt Freeman, who was the principal, and, you know, most people didn't know, you know, like what I was going through, what I was dealing with, because I was trying to be so cool. I didn't want to be the kid that was, you know, secretly being bullied.
Mm.
Those kids aren't looked at as cool.
Right.
You know, they're looked at as, you know, you're just a little punk kid. So I was keeping up this big front, sagging my pants, wearing big coats, making up hairstyles, whatever the hell I was doing. But inside, I was broken.
Yeah.
Inside, you know, I didn't want to go home and tell my mom how bad things were because, you know, she was working tons of jobs and trying to make ends meet for us. And once again, my whole thing was protect your mom. Protect your mom. I'd rather me suffer than to see her how bad my life was.
So you couldn't share it with her. You're not going to share it with your friends because you don't want them thinking of you as some charity case.
Right.
So you had to care, and the principal couldn't help you because he just was basically intimidated by the whole thing.
Right.
And it was up to you to kind of, you ended up internalizing it.
And what's funny about all that is when I went to the principal's office, I actually just left Spanish class. I didn't ask for permission. As you read it there, I just got my book, my workbook, and walked right out, walked down the hallway. And once I talked to Kurt Freeman, I just walked back in class.
Mm.
You know, I think maybe the teacher asked me what was wrong. I probably lied to her. You know, I became a really good liar at this time in my life. You know, I didn't want anybody knowing who the hell I really was. So it was just, you know, you hide all those insecurities, man. You hide everything going wrong with you because, like I said, there was two parts of David Goggins. And what I wanted people to see was I'm some tough guy that nothing could hurt me. But shit was fucking me up in a major way.
Most, if not all, minorities, women and gay people in America, know that strain of loneliness well, of walking into rooms where you are the only one of your kind. Most white men have no idea how hard it can be. I wish they did, because then they'd know how it drains you, how some days all you want to do is stay home and wallow because to go public is to be completely exposed, vulnerable to a world that tracks and judges you. At least that's how it feels. The truth is, you can't tell for sure when or if that is actually happening in a given moment. But it often feels like it, which is its own kind of mindfuck. In Brazil, I was the only everywhere I went. At my table in the cafeteria, where I chilled at lunch with Johnny and our crew, in every class I took, even in the damn basketball gym. By the end of that year, I turned 16, and my grandfather bought me a used doo-doo brown Chevy Citation. One of the first mornings I ever drove it to school, someone spray-painted the word nigger on my driver's side door. This time they spelled it correctly, and Principal Freeman was again at a loss for words. The fury that churned within me that day was indescribable, but it didn't radiate out. It broke me down from within, because I hadn't yet learned what to do or where to channel that much emotion. Was I supposed to fight everybody? I'd been suspended from school 3 times for fighting, and by now I was almost numb. Instead, I withdrew and fell into the well of black nationalism. Malcolm X became my prophet of choice. I used to come home from school and watch the same video of one of his early speeches every damn day. I was trying to find comfort somewhere, and the way he analyzed history and spun black hopelessness into rage nourished me, though most of his political and economic philosophies went over my head. It was his anger at a system made by and for white people that I connected with, because I lived in a haze of hate, trapped in my own fruitless rage and ignorance. But I wasn't Nation of Islam material. That shit took discipline, and I had none of that. Instead, by my junior year, I went out of my way to piss people off by becoming the exact stereotype racist white people loathed and feared. I wore my pants down below my ass every day. I ghetto-wired my car stereo to house speakers, which filled the trunk of my Citation. I rattled windows when I cruised down Brazil's main drag, blasting Snoop's Gin and Juice. I put 3 of those shag carpet covers over my steering wheel and dangled a pair of fuzzy dice from the rear view. Every morning before school, I stared into our bathroom mirror and came up with new ways to fuck with the racists at my school. I even concocted wild hairdos. Once I gave myself a reverse part, shaving away all my hair save a thin radial line on the left side of my scalp. It wasn't that I was unpopular. I was considered the cool black kid in town. But if you'd have bothered to drill down a little deeper, you'd see that I wasn't about black culture and that my antics weren't really trying to call out racism. I wasn't about anything at all. Everything I did was to get a reaction out of the people who hated me most, because everyone's opinion of me mattered to me, and that's a shallow way to live. I was full of pain, had no real purpose, and if you were watching from afar, it would have looked like I'd given up on any chance of success, that I was heading for disaster. But I hadn't let go of all hope. I had one more dream left. I wanted to join the Air Force. My grandfather had been a cook in the Air Force for 37 years, and he was so proud of his service that even after he retired, he'd wear his dress uniform to church on Sundays and his workaday uniform midweek just to sit on the damn porch. That level of pride inspired me to join the Civil Air Patrol, the civilian auxiliary of the Air Force. We met once a week, marched in formation, and learned about the various jobs available in the Air Force from officers, which is how I became fascinated with pararescue, the guys who jump out of airplanes to pull downed pilots out of harm's way. I attended a week-long course during the summer before my freshman year called PJOC, the Pararescue Jump Orientation Course. As usual, I was the only. One day, a pararescueman named Scott Guerin came to speak, and he had a motherfucker of a story to tell. During a standard exercise on a high-altitude jump from 13,000 feet, Guerin deployed his chute with another skydiver right above him. That wasn't out of the ordinary. He had the right of way, and per his training, he'd waved off the other jumper. Except the guy didn't see him, which placed Guerin in grave danger because the jumper above him was still mid-freefall, hurtling through the air at over 120 miles per hour. He went into a cannonball, hoping to avoid clipping Guerin, but it didn't work. Guerin had no clue what was coming when his teammate flew through his canopy, collapsing it on contact, and slammed into Guerin's face with his knees. Guerin was knocked unconscious instantly and wobbled into another freefall, his crushed chute creating very little drag. The other skydiver was able to deploy his chute and survive with minor injuries. Guerin didn't really land. He bounced like a flat basketball 3 times, but because he'd been unconscious, his body was limp, and he didn't come apart despite crashing to the ground at 100 miles per hour. He died twice on the operating table, but the ER docs brought him back to life. When he woke in a hospital bed, they said he wouldn't make a full recovery and would never be a pararescueman again. 18 months later, he defied medical odds, made that full recovery, and was back on the job he loved. David. Scott Guerin.
Yeah, this guy right here was a fucking badass, especially for a young kid who was just looking for anything to sink his hands in that gave me some hope. So I was at this PJOC camp, And basically how he was introduced was this guy named Bill Burton, who's now dead. He was a pararescueman also. Bill Burton gave this guy an introduction. He said, hey, I want you all to, you know, kind of stand up and put your hands together for Scott Guerin. And when this guy came out, when Scott came out, the first thing I noticed was his throat. His throat had been cut open to get an open airway from his accident. So I will get to that in a little bit. But when Scott came out, he sounded just like Clint Eastwood, you know, because, you know, they had messed up his throat so bad and he was telling this story. And so he went on and went on telling this story. So for 7 days, man, I would literally sit outside my tent and this guy would come out of his little hut and he would do push-ups and sit-ups and flutter kicks all day long. So I became obsessed with Scott Guerin.
Did he look fucked up aside from his throat?
No, he didn't look fucked up at all. He looked like a daggone Greek god.
Hmm.
And so I became obsessed with Scott Guerin. So we leave the pararescue or the PJOC training, and I go back home, and I keep thinking about this guy. And this is before, you know, Google and all that shit where you could find somebody. So we had no money. So I go on this hunt for Scott Guerin. And I'm literally Googling, or not Googling, but calling all these Air Force bases. Hey, are there any pararescuemen there? No. So there's very few bases that have pararescuemen. So I finally locate a base. And I'm like, hey, pararescuemen, yes. So then I'm tied into now all the PJs, all the pararescuemen. So I start getting a little bit of traction. So long story short, man, I spent over $500 on a phone bill trying to track this guy down.
You were wearing out 411, huh?
Oh my God. It was unbelievable. So I tracked the guy down and so I leave him a message and he actually calls me, but my mom answers the phone and she's like, oh my God, like my son's gonna lose his mind. And he's like, who the hell is your son? And my mom's like, he was like the only black guy in PJ training, in pararescue training. So, you know, to cut to the chase, I go stay with this guy for like 2 weeks. So I'm like begging him, can I please come stay with you? Now I know the guy for a week. We never had any interaction. I'm begging this guy to come live with him for a week. So he was a scuba instructor in Key West, Florida at the Special Forces Scuba School. So I go down and stay with him for 2 weeks. And while I'm down there, he's telling me the stories about how this kind of parachute accident happened. So his parachute accident, it's all true how it went down. But the day before the parachute accident, he was actually teaching two Navy SEALs who were not medics. He was teaching these two guys on how to cut the throat to open up an airway if something happened. So Scott and these guys go for a parachute jump. The guy goes through his parachute, knocks Scott unconscious, as you all have just heard. He hit the ground, bounced twice, and the Navy SEALs that he just taught the day before, they land on the ground, go over to Scott, and actually open his airway. So if Scott didn't teach these guys how to open up an airway, Scott would be dead today.
That's amazing.
It's truly amazing.
That's an amazing story. And that's why you audiobook listeners are stoked, because you are getting the annotated version of this amazing book.
Right. You know, it's just too much to put in the actual book, man. So, you know, I can go on and kind of freestyle some of this stuff.
Amazing stuff. And so for years, you were obsessed with Scott's story and kind of changed your life after meeting him.
Yeah, it changed my life. But, you know, I kind of went back to my old ways.
Yeah.
And but as you all hear here pretty soon, I went back to my old ways. But, yeah, he was just, you know, just that person that was like, it is possible. There was a real live Rambo out there. So it gave me some hope.
For years, I was obsessed with that story because he'd survived the impossible. And I resonated with his survival. After Wilmoth's murder, with all those racist taunts raining down on my head, I won't bore you with every single episode. Just know there were many more. I felt like I was free-falling with no fucking chute. Guerin was living proof that it's possible to transcend anything that doesn't kill you. And from the time I heard him speak, I knew I would enlist in the Air Force after graduation, which only made school seem more irrelevant, especially after I was cut from the varsity basketball team during my junior year. I wasn't cut because of my skills. The coaches knew I was one of the best players they had, and that I loved the game. Johnny and I played it night and day. Our entire friendship was based on basketball. But because I was angry at the coaches for how they used me on the JV team the year before, I didn't attend summer workouts. And they took that as a lack of commitment to the team. They didn't know or care that when they cut me, they'd eliminated any incentive I'd had to keep my GPA up, which I'd barely managed to do through cheating anyway. Now I had no good reason to attend school. At least that's what I thought, because I was clueless about the emphasis that the military places on education. I figured they'd take anybody. Two incidents convinced me otherwise and inspired me to change. The first was when I failed the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, ASVAB, during my junior year. The ASVAB is the Armed Forces version of the SATs. It's a standardized test that allows the military to assess your current knowledge and future potential for learning at the same time, and I showed up for that test prepared to do what I did best, cheat. I'd been copying on every test in every class for years, but when I took my seat for the ASVAB, I was shocked to see that the people seated to my right and left had different tests than I did. I had to go it alone and scored a 20 out of a possible 99 points. The absolute minimum standard to be admitted to the Air Force is only 36, and I couldn't even get there. The second sign that I needed to change arrived with a postmark just before school let out for the summer after junior year. My mother was still in her emotional black hole after Wilmoth's murder, and her coping mechanism was to take on as much as possible. She worked full-time at DePaul University and taught night classes at Indiana State University, because if she stopped hustling long enough to think, she would realize the reality of her life. She kept it moving, was never around, and never asked to see my grades. After the first semester of our junior year, I remember Johnny and me bringing home Fs and Ds. We spent 2 hours doctoring the ink. We turned Fs into Bs and Ds into Cs, and were laughing the whole damn time. I actually remember feeling a perverse pride in being able to show my fake grades to my mother, but she never even asked to see them. She took my damn word for it. We lived parallel lives in the same house, and since I was more or less raising myself, I stopped listening to her. In fact, about 10 days before the letter arrived, she'd kicked me out because I refused to come home from a party before curfew. She told me that if I didn't, I shouldn't come home at all. In my mind, I had already been living by myself for several years. I made my own meals, cleaned my own clothes. I wasn't angry at her. I was cocky and figured I didn't need her anymore. I stayed out that night, and for the next week and a half, I crashed at Johnny's place or with other friends. Eventually, the day came when I'd spent my last dollar. By chance, she called me at Johnny's that morning and told me about a letter from school. It said I'd missed over a quarter of the year due to unexcused absences, that I had a D average, and unless I showed significant improvement in my GPA and attendance during my senior year, I would not graduate. She wasn't emotional about it. She was more exhausted than exasperated. "I'll come home and get the note," I said. "No need for that," she replied. "I just wanted you to know that you were flunking out." I showed up on her doorstep later that day with my stomach growling. I didn't ask for forgiveness, and she didn't demand an apology. She just left the door open and walked away. I stepped into the kitchen and made myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She passed me the letter without saying a word. I read it in my room, where the walls were papered over with layers of Michael Jordan and Special Ops posters, inspiration for twin passions slipping through my fingers. That night, after taking a shower, I wiped the steam away from our corroded bathroom mirror and took a good look. I didn't like who I saw staring back. I was a low-budget thug with no purpose and no future. I felt so disgusted, I wanted to punch that motherfucker in the face and shatter glass. Instead, I lectured him. It was time to get real. "Look at you," I said. "Why do you think the Air Force wants your punk ass? You stand for nothing? You are an embarrassment." I reached for the shaving cream, smoothed the thin coat over my face, unwrapped a fresh razor, and kept talking as I shaved. "You are one dumb motherfucker. You read like a third grader. You're a fucking joke. You've never tried hard at anything in your life besides basketball, and you have goals? That's fucking hilarious." After shaving peach fuzz from my cheeks and chin, I lathered up my scalp. I was desperate for a change. I wanted to become someone new. "You don't see people in the military sagging their pants. You need to stop talking like a wannabe gangster. None of this shit is going to cut it. No more taking the easy way out. It's time to grow the fuck up." Steam billowed all around me. It rippled off my skin and poured from my soul. What started as a spontaneous venting session had become a solo intervention. "It's on you," I said. "Yeah, I know shit is fucked up. I know what you've been through. I was there, bitch. Merry fucking Christmas. Nobody is coming to save your ass. Not your mommy. Not Wilmoth. Nobody. It's up to you." By the time I was done talking, I was shaved clean. Water pearled on my scalp, streamed from my forehead, and dripped down the bridge of my nose. I looked different, and for the first time, I'd held myself accountable. A new ritual was born, one that stayed with me for years. It would help me get my grades up, whip my sorry ass into shape, and see me through graduation and into the Air Force. The ritual was simple. I'd shave my face and scalp every night, get loud, and get real. I set goals, wrote them on post-it notes, and tagged them to what I now call the accountability mirror, because each day I'd hold myself accountable to the goals I'd set. At first, my goals involved shaping up my appearance and accomplishing all my chores without having to be asked. Make your bed like you're in the military every day. Pull up your pants. Shave your head every morning. Cut the grass. Wash all dishes. The accountability mirror kept me on point from then on, and though I was still young when this strategy came through me, since then I've found it useful for people at any stage in life. You could be on the cusp of retirement, looking to reinvent yourself. Maybe you're going through a bad breakup or have gained weight. Perhaps you're permanently disabled, overcoming some other injury, or are just coming to grips with how much of your life you've wasted, living without purpose. In each case, that negativity you're feeling is your internal desire for change. But change doesn't come easy, and the reason this ritual worked so well for me was because of my tone. I wasn't fluffy. I was raw, because that was the only way to get myself right. That summer, between my junior and senior year in high school, I was afraid. I was insecure. I wasn't a smart kid. I'd blown off all accountability for my entire teenage existence and actually thought I was getting over on all the adults in my life, getting over on the system. I duped myself into a negative feedback loop of cheating and scamming that on the surface looked like advancement until I hit a brick fucking wall called reality. That night when I came home and read the letter from my school, there was no denying the truth, and I delivered it hard. I didn't dance around and say, "Geez, David, you are not taking your education very seriously." No, I had to own it in the raw, because the only way we can change is to be real with ourselves. If you don't know shit and have never taken school seriously, then say, "I'm dumb." Tell yourself that you need to get your ass to work because you're falling behind in life. If you look in the mirror and you see a fat person, don't tell yourself that you need to lose a couple of pounds. Tell the truth. You're fucking fat. It's okay. Just say you're fat if you're fat. The dirty mirror that you see every day is going to tell you the truth every time, so why are you still lying to yourself? So you can feel better for a few minutes and stay the fucking same? If you're fat, you need to change the fact that you're fat because it's very fucking unhealthy. I know, because I've been there. If you have worked for 30 years doing the same shit you've hated day in and day out because you are afraid to quit and take a risk, you've been living like a pussy. Period. Point blank. Tell yourself the truth. That you've wasted enough time, and that you have other dreams that will take courage to realize, so you don't die a fucking pussy. Call yourself out. Nobody likes to hear the hard truth. Individually and as a culture, we avoid what we need to hear most. This world is fucked up. There are major problems in our society. We are still dividing ourselves up along racial and cultural lines, and people don't have the balls to hear it. The truth is, racism and bigotry still fucking exist, and some people are so thin-skinned they refuse to admit that. To this day, many in Brazil claim that there is no racism in their small town. That's why I have to give Kirk Freeman props. When I called him in the spring of 2018, he remembered what I went through very clearly. He's one of the few who isn't afraid of the truth. But if you are the only, and you aren't stuck in some real-world genocidal twilight zone, you'd better get real too. Your life is not fucked up because of overt racist or hidden systemic racism. You aren't missing out on opportunities, making shit money, and getting evicted because of America or Donald fucking Trump, or because your ancestors were slaves, or because some people hate immigrants or Jews or harass women or believe gay people are going to hell. If any of that shit is stopping you from excelling in life, I've got some news. You are stopping you. You are giving up instead of getting hard. Tell the truth about the real reasons for your limitations, and you will turn that negativity, which is real, into jet fuel. Those odds stacked against you will become a damn runway. There is no more time to waste. Hours and days evaporate like creeks in the desert. That's why it's okay to be cruel to yourself, as long as you realize you're doing it to become better. We all need thicker skin to improve in life. Being soft when you look in the mirror isn't going to inspire the wholesale changes we need to shift our present and open up our future. The morning after that first session with the accountability mirror, I trashed the shag steering wheel and the fuzzy dice. I tucked my shirt in and wore my pants with a belt, and once school started up again, I stopped eating at my lunch table. For the first time, being liked and acting cool were a waste of my time, and instead of eating with all the popular kids, I found my own table and ate alone. Mind you, the rest of my progress could not be described as a blink-and-you'll-miss-it metamorphosis. Lady Luck did not suddenly show up, run me a hot, soapy bath, and kiss me like she loved me. In fact, the only reason I didn't become just another statistic is because at the last possible moment, I got to work. During my senior year in high school, all I cared about was working out, playing basketball, and studying, and it was the accountability mirror that kept me motivated to keep pushing toward something better. I woke up before dawn and started going to the YMCA most mornings at 5 a.m., before school, to hit the weights. I ran all the damn time, usually around the local golf course after dark. One night I ran 13 miles, the most I'd ever run in my entire life. On that run, I came to a familiar intersection. It was the same street where that redneck had pulled a gun on me. I avoided it and ran on, covering a half mile in the opposite direction before something told me to turn back. When I arrived at that intersection a second time, I stopped and contemplated it. I was scared shitless of that street. My heart was leaping from my chest, which is exactly why I suddenly started charging down its fucking throat. Within seconds, two snarling dogs got loose and chased me as the woods leaned in on both sides. It was all I could do to stay a step ahead of the beasts. I kept expecting that truck to reappear and run me the fuck down like some scene from Mississippi circa 1965, but I kept running, faster and faster until I was breathless. Eventually the hounds of hell gave up and loped off, and it was just me, the rhythm and steam of my breath, and that deep country quiet. It was cleansing. By the time I turned back, my fear was gone. I owned that fucking street. From then on, I brainwashed myself into craving discomfort. If it was raining, I would go run. Whenever it started snowing, my mind would say, "Get your fucking running shoes on." Sometimes I wussed out and had to deal with it at the accountability mirror. But facing that mirror, facing myself, motivated me to fight through uncomfortable experiences, and as a result, I became tougher, and being tough and resilient helped me meet my goals. Nothing was as hard for me as learning. The kitchen table became my all-day, all-night study hall. After I'd failed the ASVAB a second time, my mother realized that I was serious about the Air Force, so she found me a tutor who helped me figure out a system I could use to learn. That system was memorization. I couldn't learn just by scratching a few notes and memorizing those. I had to read a textbook and write each page down in my notebook, then do it again a second and third time. That's how knowledge stuck to the mirror of my mind, not through learning, but through transcription, memorization, and recall. I did that for English. I did that for history. I wrote out and memorized formulas for algebra. If my tutor took an hour to teach me a lesson, I had to go back over my notes from that session for 6 hours to lock it in. My personal study hall schedule and goals became post-it notes on my accountability mirror. And guess what happened? I developed an obsession for learning. Over 6 months, I went from having a fourth grade reading level to that of a senior in high school. My vocabulary mushroomed. I wrote out thousands of flashcards and went over them for hours, days, and weeks. I did the same for mathematical formulas. Part of it was survival instinct. I damn sure wasn't going to get into college based on academics, and though I was a starter on the varsity basketball team my senior year, no college scouts knew my name. All I knew was that I had to get the fuck out of Brazil, Indiana, that the military was my best chance, and to get there I had to pass the ASVAB. On my third try, I met the minimum standard for the Air Force. Living with purpose changed everything for me, at least in the short term. During my senior year in high school, studying and working out gave my mind so much energy that hate flaked from my soul like used-up snake skin. The resentment I held toward the racists in Brazil, the emotion that had dominated me and was burning me up inside, dissipated because I'd finally considered the fucking source. I looked at the people who were making me feel uncomfortable and realized how uncomfortable they were in their own skin. To make fun of or try to intimidate someone they didn't even know based on race alone was a clear indication that something was very wrong with them, not me. But when you have no confidence, it becomes easy to value other people's opinions, and I was valuing everyone's opinion without considering the minds that generated them. That sounds silly, but it's an easy trap to fall into, especially when you are insecure on top of being the only. As soon as I made that connection, being upset with them was not worth my time, because if I was going to kick their ass in life, and I was, I had way too much shit to do. Each insult or dismissive gesture became more fuel for the engine revving inside me. By the time I graduated, I knew that the confidence I'd managed to develop didn't come from a perfect family or God-given talent. It came from personal accountability, which brought me self-respect, and self-respect will always light a way forward. For me, it lit up a path straight out of Brazil, forever. But I didn't get away clean. When you transcend a place and time that has challenged you to the core, it can feel like you've won a war. Don't fall for that mirage. Your past, your deepest fears, have a way of going dormant before springing back to life at double strength. You must remain vigilant. For me, the Air Force revealed that I was still soft inside. I was still insecure. I wasn't yet hard of bone and mind. This is a good principle, the accountability mirror.
Yes, man, the accountability mirror is something that started it all for me. And it was so much easier to be someone else. That's why, you know, acting like I was cool, acting like a wannabe thug, sagging my pants, I was just living a dream world. Let's not be David Goggins. Let's just be this funny-looking character that's not dealing with his own problems. So it made my life so much easier to not deal with this fucked up life that I had.
But I, at the same time, I could see how you'd do it. Like you were kind of thriving. The comedy aspect of it does help you deal with it to some sense. It was almost like, it almost like was a painkiller, the comedy aspect of it, right?
Oh yeah. You know what's funny? It's the honest truth what you say. But the scary thing about it is you accomplish nothing.
Right.
Nothing gets accomplished. So yeah, it helped me kind of, get by.
Yeah.
But that's all I was doing was getting by. And I was afraid. I was really afraid to go back in that pile of shit. And by 18, 19 years old, I already had so much crap that I had to go through. I just kept putting it off.
Mm.
And the scary thing about it was I always knew that I had it in me. I always knew I had it in me to learn. I always knew I had it in me to be better. But I knew that it was going to take me so many more hours than the normal person. I knew that I was coming into the game at such a deficit. And, you know, I didn't have these great parents. I didn't have this great foundation. So I had to almost by myself start rebuilding a house.
Mm.
And I knew what kind of work that was going to take for me to do this. So I just kept running away from the work.
What made you decide that it was the post-it notes? Because at first I could see you talking to yourself in the mirror and it becoming like its own trance.
Right.
But how did you decide to go to the post-it notes and start to actually make them kind of work detail?
So what was crazy about it is that my mind, the way it works, is if I don't have constant reminders, I will... Your path is, like, you know, your mind is constantly looking for the path of least resistance. So if you're not constantly challenging yourself every day, for a person like me, if I'm not constantly looking at, okay, the task at hand today on my post-it notes on this mirror is to do this, my mind's going to say, hey, let's not do that today. Let's go over here, go to Johnny's house, play basketball, and just fuck around. So I had to have a constant reminder of, hey, all right, David, we have to do X, Y, and Z today, or we can't do this and that. So I had to earn everything in my life from that point forward.
I remember Johnny, when we talked to Johnny, saying that it was almost like you just disappeared. Like he wanted to play basketball and you'd be at the kitchen table studying because you hadn't knocked it out yet.
You know what's funny about that, man? I didn't pick up a basketball. So this happened my junior year and then my senior year, I played basketball. I didn't pick up a basketball for about 20 years.
Really?
Yep. And that's something I don't tell anybody. So basketball was my love, but I realized that basketball became my escape. And I no longer could escape from my life. So I started choosing whatever made me uncomfortable, I realized that I had to start gravitating towards that. And it was a long process. It wasn't like I woke up one morning looked in the accountability mirror and figured out, oh, let me write some post-it notes down here and start doing this. We all have a voice in our head. We all have a voice in our head that is trying to direct you to a place where you can be better. We also have another voice in our head that's saying, ah, fuck that, let's not do that. So whatever that voice was saying that kind of sucked, that sucky voice that made me very uncomfortable, I started realizing that that's the only voice I can listen to. The other voice was a voice of comfort, and I had to stop listening to that voice because it always took me down the path of least resistance. Mm.
So this challenge that we set up is for your readers and listeners to set up their own accountability mirror.
Right.
And you've never really laid out that challenge to your followers before, have you?
No, this is something brand new. I've never even, well, I talk about the accountability mirror every now and then, but this is definitely brand new.
Where you're breaking out like how-tos about it.
Exactly.
Challenge number two, it's time to come eyeball to eyeball with yourself and get raw and real. This is not a self-love tactic. You can't fluff it. Don't massage your ego. This is about abolishing the ego and taking the first step toward becoming the real you. I tack post-it notes on my accountability mirror, and I'll ask you to do the same. Digital devices won't work. Write all your insecurities, dreams, and goals on post-its and tag up your mirror. If you need more education, remind yourself that you need to start working your ass off because you aren't smart enough. Period. Point blank. If you look in the mirror and see someone who is obviously overweight, that means you're fucking fat. Own it. It's okay to be unkind with yourself in these moments because we need thicker skin to improve in life. Whether it's a career goal, quit my job, start a business, a lifestyle goal, lose weight and get more active, or an athletic one, run my first 5K, 10K, or marathon, you need to be truthful with yourself about where you are and the necessary steps it will take to achieve those goals, day by day. Each step, each necessary point of self-improvement should be written as its own note. That means you have to do some research and break it all down. For example, if you're trying to lose 40 pounds, your first post-it may be to lose 2 pounds in the first week. Once that goal is achieved, remove the note and post the next goal of 2 to 5 pounds until your ultimate goal is realized. Whatever your goal, you'll need to hold yourself accountable for the small steps it will take to get there. Self-improvement takes dedication and self-discipline. The dirty mirror you see every day is going to reveal the truth. Stop ignoring it. Use it to your advantage. If you feel it, post an image of yourself staring into your tagged up accountability mirror on social media with the hashtags, hashtag can't hurt me, hashtag accountability mirror. Talk about the tone and what it means to be, have thicker skin and why that's so important.
You know, we live in a world nowadays, especially now, we live in a soft generation, man. People are very soft, and people hate to admit that they're wrong. They hate to admit that they're wrong. Like, I mean, even for very simple things, it's much easier to blame somebody. People, that whole accountability thing, it sounds so simple. But how many times do you sit in a room when somebody messes up and no one really says, hey, I messed up. Hey, I apologize, I messed up. That's one of the hardest things to do. So that whole thick skin is to be able to take criticism, be able to criticize yourself. Why? We live in this society and we believe that everybody is so great and so perfect, but we haven't really realized that everybody's fucked up. Everybody's fucked up, even the people who are judging you. All that they're doing better than you is they're hiding. They're able to hide better than you are. So they make you feel like you're a piece of shit because they don't want to hold themselves accountable. So the whole thick skin thing is, whatever you are, own it. The only way you're going to lose weight is to say, hey, I'm overweight. I'm fat. You might be obese. The only way you're going to fix being smarter is say, you know what? I'm not the smartest cat in the world. I need to fix these things that I'm lacking in. And that's the only way I got better was to develop thick skin. You know, back in the day, somebody would have called me dumb. You know, yeah, it hurts your feelings, but are you dumb? Are you dumb? Yeah, it's hurtful. It hurts your feelings. Yeah, no one wants to hear it. But sometimes bullies are just telling you the fucking truth in a very mean way. And that's how you got to look at it. You got to look at, you know what, man? I'm not the smartest cat in the world. But use that strength. Use, like, you know, if you're getting bullied in a way, if they're calling you fat, don't go home and put your head down. Go home and say, you know what, I am fat. But I'm going to lose some fucking weight and go back to school or go back to whatever and say, hey, look at me now. Take a different vantage point in life. Don't look at it as always being hurt. Grow that thick skin. Grow daggone alligator skin. To where nothing can hurt you. Not thick skin, grow alligator skin. And that's right there where you start getting the tactical advantage over everything, over yourself. Like I said before, your mind is always at the tactical advantage. It knows your fears. It knows your insecurities. You can't outrun them. So you might as well face them, hold yourself accountable, and then start to fix them.
Yeah, it's like in these days, everyone wants to sit in their feelings and have their feelings validated. Like, this is my emotional process. This is that. But what you're saying is, you know, there's a lot more to what you feel. You can't believe everything you feel.
Right.
And sometimes you have to go deeper and find your way out of the feeling.
Right. And even deeper than that is that a lot of people start to hang around people that, you know, allow them to have no accountability. You know, they have friends that say, oh yeah, it's their fault. They start to tell you everything you want to hear. And that's how you group your friends. You got that run friend that comes in there and says, hey man, no, you're kind of fucked up. You need to change your way. You no longer want to hang with that person.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got to look at, so this is all encompassing about everything you do in life. Pick the people around you that are going to hold you to a higher standard, not a lower standard that makes you feel better.
I like it. I think that's one of the biggest problems in society is that people are afraid to hear what they don't want to hear. And it makes us all worse off.
100%, man. And especially nowadays.
Yeah.
It's a much kinder, gentler world where everybody's winning. And at the end of the day, all you're doing is losing.